You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on
KISO
88.7
Avalon.
How you doing? This is Ron Trupa with the Catalina Film Festival and Catalina Film Radio program. We, as our guest, have today Brandon Vetter, who is the writer, producer, and editor of La Source, the movie that will be screening this weekend on Saturday at 1 p.m. at the Avalon Community Church, along with a short film that he directed and produced called The Catalina Explore Project. So come out 1 o'clock and come see his two little masterpieces. Brandon, how are you?
Good, good. Oh. Thanks for having me, Ron.
No problem. And I also want to add, which I didn't add, is that you'll be out there for the Q&A, and you'll actually be doing a question and answer session with the Film Society members and the audience.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for offering your time and your work. We know it's pretty personal stuff. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I have a very big place in my heart for Catalina, so any chance I get to get out there and interact, I will take it.
That's awesome. And, you know, and that's what I was going to ask before I get into the actual films.
Yeah.
How does a guy from Evanston, Illinois have, you know, a warm place in his heart for Catalina? You know, what was your journey?
Yeah, no, that is a good question. Well, it's funny that it kind of synced back up once I got out there and learned that the Cubs had been doing their spring training there for so long, and it seemed like destiny for me to fall in love with this place. But yeah, you know, I started working with a company called Fuse Group, and a guy named Zach Smith, who's around the island a lot, and I'm sure a lot of the Islanders know, and he was doing tourism videos and documentaries for the island company, and he hired me to help him with that. And, you know, I was blessed to get some amazing access to the interior of the island, shooting all of their tourism videos, and just kind of like fell head over heels in love with this place. You know, and that led me to actually hike the majority of the island, and, you know, just get out there as much as I possibly can.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And what was, I guess before, I mean, that makes more sense now because, you know, the Chicago Cubs, which I should have known, it's pretty close to Chicago. I thought it had to do with Lake Michigan. I was like, oh, he misses Lake Michigan. So at what point, you live in Los Angeles now.
Yeah.
Right? What point did you move out here to pursue the dream, and why was the dream there? What was your catalyst to be a filmmaker?
Yeah, you know, I ended up moving to Northern California when I was in grade school, and grew up kind of the rest of my adolescence in high school in Northern California. And when I get into college, I honestly, coming out of high school, I felt that I wanted to be a biological ethicist. And that was something that was very interesting to me. And, you know, it just made a lot of sense to me in high school in terms of the classes I was taking and the things that I was being exposed to. And when I got into college, that started to unravel quickly as something that made sense for me to do.
Was it all the biology classes that did it or what?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was just kind of the... It's just an intense amount of knowledge versus the actual opportunity for application was, you know, the disparity was so huge there that it was just like, I want to be using these things that I'm learning and, you know, be really active with kind of my imagination and the opportunities that kind of stuff provides. So I started kind of writing and that just clicked in me. And, you know, storytelling had always been something that I loved. And, you know, so everything kind of synced up right there. I was living in the basement of a house in Chico, California, and kind of became a hermit for like 6 months and just ingested as many films as I could get my hands on, made my first short film without any formal training, and, you know, just ended up realizing that I was kind of, once I went to film school, that I had kind of started off making them in the correct way, in terms of how the format of filmmaking is. So yeah, just kind of made it, you know, tried to make it work on my own kind of energy, and, you know, it was there that it started making a lot of sense. And then from there, I started touring with the band Pearl Jam and shooting them, and I shot them about 5 nights a week for 3 or 4 months, making a concert documentary with them, and that really gave me the opportunity to hone my skills and be in a high pressure situation every night where I had to get the right footage. And, you know, we were also shooting enough where I had a great opportunity to, you know, experiment with angles and just really figure out what works for me and kind of my voice as a filmmaker. And so, yeah, from there, I went to film school, and I just have been creating as much as possible since.
So now I see that, you know, Pearl Jam Live at the Garden is your first credit on IMDb. So
yeah.
Which one was first? Was it that film, or was it the digesting film and your, did the first short film come first, or was that documentary first? Which one was the first part of the filmmaking process?
Yeah, it was the first narrative short film came first, and then came the documentary. And I've always kind of gone back and forth in terms of documentary and more narrative scripted filmmaking, which has been, you know, I wouldn't do it any other way, because you get so much different energy out of either art form, and they're so different, but they really inform each other in an incredible way. And shooting documentary and getting into situations with people in an immense amount of depravity or happiness or love or connection, and really getting to witness those moments in humans in the moment has made me a better narrative filmmaker, because I've been, you know, just the access that you get as a documentary filmmaker, once you get the trust of your subjects, really kind of, you know, like pushes you into a new understanding of people, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I know on the side, although I'm sure it's not too hard for people to piece together, that Eddie Vedder is your cousin, considering you both have the same last name. Do you think that? Do you? And it's a unique last name. Do you think that gave you a little bit more of an edge as far as a documentary perspective? Like, was there a little more trust backstage? Was there a little bit more inside the curtain that you may have had that other filmmakers or videographers or cinematographers wouldn't have?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's definitely the reason why I got the opportunity. But Eddie was very, you know, kind of like specific about not wanting to make it harder for me than it already would be with kind
right.
of, you know, this touring crew has been together forever. And, you know, I started that when I was 20 years old, and everyone was at least 10 or 15 years older than me. And really, to be honest, gave me a really hard time the first couple months of tour, just because I was the singer's cousin and, you know, like, I didn't deserve to be there. And so it actually really helped me. It was incredibly hard and discouraging at first because I was just alone. But I think that it really helped me grow up quickly in terms of professionalism. And, like, I had to win that whole crew over on my own. And
sure.
I just had to work my butt off and earn everyone's respect. So, you know, the opportunity definitely, you know, was sprouted from that relation. But if anything, I was treated more harshly because of that relation in terms of the rest of the crew and access and stuff. So.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I always had the theory that nepotism makes you really good or really bad, because, you know, it's one thing to get your foot in the door. It's another thing to stay in the door. But, you know, and then that's, you think, like you said, you have to earn.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on
KISO
88.7
Avalon.
Your stripes even harder. But my question was more of like, you know, was there more comfort with you behind the camera? Did you get more? I haven't seen the film. I'm sorry. I haven't seen Live at the Garden. But were there backstage personal moments in it where, like, maybe you were able to get that than another have behind the camera? Or was that not even part of the equation?
I see. No, yeah, it ended up not really being, it was more of a straight concert film. And we shot for months every night, and we ended up deciding that was the concert, you know, that was the film. Concert was just, became this iconic moment in their history. They actually made the garden shake because, you know, Madison Square Garden is on top of the train station, and it has these earthquake risers, and there's only been 5 bands in the history of the garden that have ever made it shake like that. And it was shaking so bad that the band ran off the stage because they were terrified that it was an earthquake, and they didn't want, you know, people to keep rocking around, and like, it just became this very intense moment. And then a really joyous moment once we realized that it was just because they were rocking so hard and everyone was going so nuts. So yeah, just became this really special concert, and Ben Harper was there and a lot of special guests. And so we just decided that was the one that we wanted to release.
Oh, that's cool, man. That's scary and fascinating at all at the same time. Like, I knew Grand Central was under there, but I didn't know they got earthquakes in the garden.
Me either.
What car is it on rollers?
Yeah, it's on like earthquake risers, shocks, things. You know, and if you get the right amount of movement in kind of the right way, it starts shaking. And our tour manager comes out after the band runs off, after they figure out what happens, and to the crowd and says, you know, you've just made Pearl Jam one of the 5 bands that has ever done this. The crowd goes nuts, and he's like, let me list them off for you. It's Iron Maiden, The Boss, you know, like just going through all these iconic bands. Yeah.
The Stones, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome. Cool.
Yeah, it was great.
All right, yeah. Well, maybe there's some future behind-the-scenes footage that'll come out in a DVD release this year, the 10-year anniversary.
Yeah, exactly.
Just giving you ideas. So then you go on, and again, it's IMDb, which doesn't always have all the credits that you do outside of making IMDb credits. The next thing I see is 2005. So what were you doing right after that? Did that inspire you to just jump right into your narratives or another documentary or?
Yeah, that's when I started jumping it really head first into my narrative stuff. And, you know, I was able to make enough money doing the Pearl Jam thing to put myself through film school. So I went immediately down to L.A. and enrolled in film school and just started making all of those narrative mistakes that you have to get out of your system, you know, to become a good filmmaker. And, you know, it's all those suicide stories and all, you know, just kind of that film school stuff that, you know, exactly. Everyone just has to get it out of their system. And it was a good experience for me. I've met a lot of the filmmakers that I'm still working with today in that program. And, yeah, I was actually able to bring the source back to my school and show it there. And that was a really cool kind of, you know, end of the circle, and, you know, completed that cycle and did a long Q&A with in a class that I had taken. And, you know, it was very cool to be able to come back and, you know, see where the school was at and, you know, be able to kind of, you know, show my film there as well.
Oh, that's awesome. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's got to be a little surreal, too, like when you actually go back to your school and be like, I used to be here dreaming about one day what I would do. And, you know, then you're coming back as, you know, an accredited filmmaker, got your laurels on the film festival circuit. You got an Academy Award nominee narrating your films. I mean, that had to be one of those moments.
Yeah, no, it definitely was. I remember it was a really busy week, but I was taking a shower right before I headed down, and I realized that I had, you know, that class was in a theater and we would watch films and then have Q&As with filmmakers, and they had David Tuohy, who did pitch black, and, you know, like, he's been doing big films, and I remember watching him, you know, watch one of his films and watch him speak, and I remember sitting there saying, one day, I'm going to get up there, you know, and I kind of realized when I was in the shower, like, wow, I actually did something that I said I was going to do.
That's
and,
awesome.
You know, was on a pretty big high about that.
That's cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we're not quite at Little Source yet. I saw a film today because I saw it on the screen online called Pufferfish.
Yes.
And it was written, directed, wasn't shot by you. No. Written, directed, and edited by you?
Yeah. Yep.
Hello?
Yep. I'm still here.
So was this from film school? Or was this after film school?
You know what? This was after film school. And what this was is, you know, I was living with some guests from film school. We had moved to L.A. We had just moved, you know, like a little north into L.A. And we kind of, you know, we were just making a living and doing lots of corporate work and just kind of like really getting our freelance legs about us. And, you know, and just kind of realized that we hadn't made anything in way too long. And, you know, so we just kind of rounded everyone up. Looked at the equipment we had, looked at, you know, like the actors that we knew and the locations that we could steal, and wrote something really quickly and just made it happen. You know, it was very much a spirit, in the spirit of, you know, low budget stealing shots kind of mentality. So yeah, that was to keep us sane kind of project. And then this really fun little film that, you know, played around the festival circuit a little bit.
Yeah, and it was about two friends, and they were kind of, you know, I don't know, maybe you want to give a synopsis for, because obviously people haven't seen it, or they could go online and Google Pufferfish, and you can watch it online.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about these two friends and kind of, you know, they're just kind of a junk show of a day in their life, you know. Where they just encourage each other in kind of the wrong way to get into bad situations and somehow get out of them. And yeah, just, you know, it's kind of a,
trying to lend him a suit, and he's got three at home, and he's like, why borrow my suit then? And the reason is just my little actor studio kind of, build up is I'm just trying to kind of get the origin of where your filmmaking started, and then kind of, because the one thing that we like to do, and the one thing we always ask our film society members, you know, is like, well, you know, you loved this film that you just watched, but what do you think the journey of it was? How many years do you think it took for them to make this? You know, because they're curious, and a lot of the times they see these films that are so amazing, and they're like, well, why isn't this in theaters across the country? And why isn't this, you know, something that I can find anywhere? And they don't understand, you know, the journey of filmmaking is long, and you got to really just kind of find your way and your niche. You're going from documentaries, you're dabbling in shorts, narratives, and, you know, you're kind of doing a lot of everything, probably, you know, especially coming through film school and then trying to dabble in where, you know, where you find your interest.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio. On
KISO
88.7
Avalon. And then, like, for Pufferfish, it seemed like it was scripted and not scripted at the same time. It seemed like there were a lot of ad libs. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's, you know, that was my first kind of experiment. I had been watching a lot of a HBO show called Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, which has it's a very loosely scripted show. You know, they set up situations and kind of let the actors work their way through those situations. And so listening to the filmmakers behind that talk made me very interested in that process. And so I kind of came up with the skeleton of the story and where I wanted to go, and talk to the actors about who their characters were and what kind of things, how they would react to things. And we just kind of, you know, like, talked a lot about who these people were and their challenges and you know, kind of why they were so kind of hilariously doomed. And then we just kind of let it go. And every shot in every scene in that film is one take. So the idea behind that was to frame up a shot that gave the actors to work room to work within, and just give them kind of a palette to work within and not have to, and, you know, them to have to do the same thing over and over again. I really wanted to experiment with capturing true moments and true funny moments, within these interactions. And I thought the best way to do that would to just be kind of to let the camera be a little less active and just kind of watch what happens and let the actors use this space that I've given them.
Yeah. I mean, Brandon, I'm so glad you said that. I am so glad you said that, because that was my next question for you. I love the way you frame shots. I mean, you're a true cinematographer and slash photographer at heart, because, you know, this was probably the third piece of work that I've seen you do, and I only saw it today on a quick internet search. But I noticed that you really take care in how you frame your shots. And your films are very vivid and visceral, and, you know, like, you know, I can tell in the Catalina Explore project and in La Source that you do a lot with, I don't know what it's officially called, but I call it like a micro focus, where like you really zoom in on what you want people to be tasting, and the rest of it kind of blurs out a little.
Yeah, but absolutely.
Where'd you get that love? I mean, not everybody has that. See, to me, that's sort of like the raw talent. You can learn technique, but it's more of a passion that you feel. And it's like a signature. And I see that in your films, that you're really very careful about what you're letting people watch. And you do it. I would say you're a minimalist, but you do it with some camera tricks that not everybody uses, which would be hard for them to sometimes pull off.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited that you noticed that. Because that's definitely something that I've always tried to do. And, you know, I've throughout the years of doing this, I've tried to get closer and closer to my instinct and, like, what just makes sense, and not try to overthink it, and kind of try to unlearn all the things that I've learned about how you're supposed to frame things and how things are supposed to happen. And just kind of, you know, like, try to feel what's right for the scene. And like you said, what I do want the audience to be experiencing. And the more films that I make, the more that I realize that tone is the most important factor for me in filmmaking. You know, it's not plot, it's not, you know, it's not the big picture. It's really like, I'm very interested in affecting the way people feel when they watch a piece of mine. And I would like to be able to, you know, have that effect last a little bit after they've seen it. And I think one of the best tools in that is the way that they're experiencing this film in the cinematography. And like you said, what they're looking at, and, you know, trying the balance of that, trying not to make it too forceful and too kind of like myopic.
Correct. I think if you do it incorrectly, and people can be distracting, but I mean, you do it in a very complimentary way. I think is that what you're saying? Then, while I interrupt.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I hope to. That's definitely what I strive for. And, you know, when I think about tone, I usually think about cinematography first. So, yeah.
Nice. So that's how you attack a project, is basically on your shot list, or even more in-depth than that, more in-depth than the shot list, is it, do you attack it from, what sort of lenses do I want to use, what, you know, where am I going to put the camera?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely been evolving over the years and throughout the projects. And, you know, like, that's just the greatest thing about being able to be a filmmaker and take on a lot of projects is, you know, you get to make mistakes and you get to try things out. And the more that I'm able to try things out, the more that I realize that, you know, it's, for me, it's become more about kind of backing into a project, like, you know, to not startle it away. Because in the past, I have, like, went head-on into projects and just started writing them and went plot-heavy and just kind of, like, forced this thing into existence. And more recently, I've been kind of, like, sneaking up on projects and backing into them a little bit and thinking about them less in terms of their structure and more in terms of just the tone of the piece and kind of like the overall vibe of what I'd like to capture, and then kind of just let the scenes and, you know, kind of the imagery swirl around that. And, you know, I definitely don't have a technical mind for that. Like, I wouldn't be the one who's like, you know, this is the kind of camera I want to use, this is the kind of lensing I want to use, but I know exactly what I want, and it's just a matter of, you know, trying to find the right combination or working with the right people to achieve that look.
Yeah, and I have seen more of your work too, because I've seen a lot of the video footage for the Island Company that you did with their hotels and their zip lines and stuff too, and I saw a lot of that same, you know, style that you know, looks cool. You bring to the lens.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on KISO 88.7.
Yeah, that was, you know, being able to do the Explore project was just a blast, because, you know, with Catalina, it's like, we really tried to make Catalina a character in that film. And, you know, with Catalina, it's like everywhere you point the camera, it's gold. Like, it's just...
Yeah. Why don't you tell them what the Explore project is?
Okay, so the Catalina Explore project is a film that I collaborated again with Zach Smith on. And the idea was to get some paddleboarders that have never been out to Catalina Island, but who are experienced paddleboarders. And paddleboarders, that is, you know, kind of the big, long, wide surfboard that you stand on top of your way through, you know, rivers, oceans, whatever. And so the idea was to have these three paddleboarders that have been experienced in all different kind of situations paddleboard around, circumnavigate the islands. And it turned into this amazing adventure where, you know, the first night we got all the way around from Two Harbors to Shark Harbor, and we woke up to gale force winds the next day. And we were trailing in the sailboats, and then Zodiacs as well, shooting the project. And, it just became this very, very intense day where, you know, we had like 5-6 foot swells, and we're out there on a little Zodiac with a bunch of camera gear and still trying to capture what these guys are doing. And at one point, you know, one of them had to actually jump on the boat because it just became too much. And, you know, we saw like a nice great white out there. And, you know, there was a lot going on. But, you know, and then after that, it was amazing because we were able to come in to, you know, that seal breeding ground, which became like this light at the end of the tunnel. The sun came out. The seals gave us this like amazing welcome, and there were so many amazing little things that the island threw our way on that project. So I'm really, really excited about people who haven't gotten to see it through your film festival last year to check it out, you know, this weekend.
Yeah, and you know, the imagery again, the I don't know how much the camera corrects or how much the color correction you do in post. But it's just real sharp, HD, vivid, you know, beautiful pictures of the island. I mean, you know, in motion. So it is.
Yeah.
It's really interesting because a lot of people don't get to see, you know, the all around the island. They don't do that themselves, and they probably won't unless, you know, they want to take the boat around and stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You guys get real intimate with it.
Yeah, I've become kind of a ridiculous advocate of the island and spending time in the interior, because people that have been out to the island, you know, talk about Avalon or maybe Two Harbors, but, you know, have never really seen anything else in the island. And to me, like, the real diamond is the interior. And, you know, like, some of those beaches on the backside of the island, you know, are just like nothing I've ever seen.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is a unique part of the world, and not everybody has access to it.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
You get to see it through your lens.
Yes.
So that's a 24-minute short documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Were you, and we're going to show that before The Source. Now, did you shoot The Source before this or after this or around the same time?
Yeah, you're kind of trying to figure that out because The Source has created quite a fog in terms of time in my head. I started The Source almost 4 years ago now. So I think that I shot the Explore project on a break from The Source, because what happened with The Source was we started shooting the film a few weeks before the devastating earthquake happened in Haiti. And so that kind of really kickstarted the film and, you know, just fast forwarded everything and kind of, you know, made it clear that we were not going to have time for pre-production and, you know, like to really set this up in the way that you would always want to set a film up, because it was happening and we had to get out there and start capturing it. So, you know, from then on, for the next year and a half, we went out to Haiti probably once a month for, you know, anywhere from like 8 to 12 days each time.
Wow. So now, before you continue, I'm just going to let everybody know that, you know, or you can help with the synopsis, that you started The Source before the earthquake, and it had to do with two brothers. And what was their
name? Yeah, so, the film follows these two brothers, one who's living in Princeton, New Jersey, working as a janitor at the university during the day. He drives a taxi at night. The man is the hardest working, most selfless person that I've ever come across. He sends all his money back to Haiti, and just continues to work. And, you know, his brother lives back in Haiti in their home village, and they kind of inherited this dream from their father to bring clean water to their village for the first time in the history of the village. The water situation there has just gotten worse and worse with, you know, the advent of, you know, chemical detergents and stuff like that. People, lower income people having access to those kind of, you know, toxins. And using them in the rivers and to clean their motorcycles and to clean their animals. And, you know, like, their water sources have just gotten worse and worse. And so Josue, who's our main character, and his brother Chris Madon have, you know, banded together to try to fix this problem, which they were doing by themselves before the earthquake. And once the earthquake happens, all of these students that Josue was serving during the day at Princeton, cleaning their toilets, bringing them, you know, like the things that they needed, taking out their trash, they started to become interested in Haiti and his heritage and what his life was like there. And it came out that this project that he was trying to do, just him and his brother, and, you know, these kids, obviously very intelligent kids, very self-starting kids, started to help raise money for this project and really kind of wrapped themselves around him and, you know, started all these events and started all these fundraisers and, you know, like raised the majority of the money that it took for Josue to be able to bring fresh water to his village. It's a David and Goliath story for sure. Like, there's no reason that this janitor that's just barely scraping by in the States should be able to, you know, save his entire village like this.
Yeah. No, it's one of those, you know, I mean, everyone's written about it, and, you know, you've got the quotes even on the trailer, but it's just such an inspiring story, and, you know, it gives you goosebumps.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, and that's, we kind of noticed when we premiered the film this summer at the AFI Discovery Channel Silver Docs Film Festival, and we kind of realized that people were reacting to the film in kind of a depressing way. Like, before they had seen the film, they were thinking, oh, this is about a poor immigrant. This is about the worst natural disaster of our generation. This is about, you know, the lack of clean water, which is the biggest humanitarian issue that we're facing today. Like, this film is going to depress me. This film is going to make me sad. And, you know, the film does opposite of that. Like, the film is very much about hope and very much about, you know, when like-minded individuals come together to change something, just how possible it is. And you know, like, it's a very real-world example of, you know, just the human will and what's possible when passionate people get together. You know, thousands of lives can be changed in months. So yeah, we've worked really hard to try to change the view of how people see the film. And we were able to get a really great review out of Kenneth Turan at the LA Times, who's, I've been reading his reviews since I was a kid. He's like one of the most famous film reviewers. And he, his pull quote from his review was, there are some documentaries that make you feel good about the world and the people in it, and La Source is one of those documentaries. And when we read that, we were just like, that's it, like, that's going to save this film. And so, yeah, that's really had a huge impact on people's, you know, their thoughts about what they're going into when they see this film. So, yeah, it's definitely not what it seems to be.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on
KISO
88.7 Avalon.
So what's happened since the film? Have you gotten people that have written you letters saying other things that they've done because the film inspired them? And
yeah, you know, it's been incredibly inspiring to see, you know, the community support that's happened out of this film. We've been using the film as kind of a tool in an arsenal to try to raise money to, so we've created a social action campaign around this film. And the idea is to raise $400,000, $200,000 to build a school in La Source that you meet in the film. And, you know, now that they don't know that they don't have to walk miles to get water every day, twice a day, now they actually have time to go to school. You know, like, this is something that we just don't think about. Like, these kids have just, they have a full-time job of going to get water for their families, so they don't have time for education. And so there was no real opportunity for education in that area. And now that that burden has been lifted off of them, because Josue was able to bring them clean water, they have an opportunity to go to school. So we found it really important to provide a school for them. And the school will also double as a medical clinic. So there will be medical services in that area, which there have never been. And the other half of that fundraiser will be, we've identified 20 to 25 more areas in Haiti that are in a very similar desperation for water, that we've been able to figure out that we can simply dig wells and fix the problem. You know, that's the thing about this water issue is it's not like the AIDS crisis where you have to invest millions of dollars into research to try to figure out what we can do about changing the way that this disease is affecting our culture. With water, like, this problem is so fixable. It costs about $5,000 to $6,000 to dig a well in, you know, 80% of the land in the world, and you can find water right there. And it's like, you know, a well, you know, it takes care of, you know, 1,000 people. So, you know, we're trying to get that message out where it's just like, yes, this is becoming the biggest humanitarian crisis of our time, lack of water, but the solutions are right there. And it just takes a little bit of money and a little bit of sacrifice to get that. So,
Brandon, I was in Guatemala last August with my friend's organization called Shayla Aid. And for the past 20 years, they've been operating up in the San Martin Mountains in the village of San Martin. And yeah. that's exactly the problems they were facing. And they've built a clinic, and they've had education. We just put in, we were there in August, we put in a brand new satellite internet system. So now the kids have gone literally from dirt floors to now being able to learn on computers and talk to us through the internet. And
wow.
they have a clean water program that, you know, for like $100, they have about a 5-gallon clay, it's like a clay pot with like a wire mesh inside that filters all the impurities, all the worms, all the parasites out of the water. Any type of water that they put in this 5-gallon, the clay pot's surrounded by a plastic 5-gallon bucket and a spigot, but
it
can last for a year. And so even if the source isn't there, they can still go grab water and filter it and have clean water in their home for up to a year until the clay pot needs to be needs. So,
wow.
you know, and like you said, it takes so little of what we have to make this
right.
happen and make it a real reality for people to just not be sick.
That right, exactly. Because
truly no excuse.
Right, and there's just nothing, there's no reason to invest in a community outside of clean water. Like, you know, there's no reason to build a hospital in a place that doesn't have clean water. There's no reason to build a school in a place that doesn't have clean water. Like, that's the first step, like, to get people drinking clean water, because regardless, they're going to have diarrhea and, you know, they're not going to be able to keep a strong immune system. And, you know, it's just like, it's just the first step. And that's, I, the focus needs to be there. And like you were saying, like, what an amazing plan that has kind of worked and come in to play there. There's been so many people that have made so many amazing innovations in terms of cleaning water, purifying water, and it's all out there. Like, it's just about the implementation and, you know, like-minded people giving a little bit of their resources to help make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you
yeah.
know, I think, you know, the interesting thing about all these organizations, and then we'll wrap up, but I think that people really feel like they're worlds away from them. They really
right.
don't think they can have a direct impact. And unfortunately,
yeah.
there's a lot of interesting nonprofits out there that maybe take more than they should operationally and give less to what their cause is supposed to be. So I think there's also an apprehension with people trying to support certain causes that they don't know or
yeah.
they don't know too much about. But I think when
right.
you really do your research and you find out there are really good organizations out there, it takes so little to help. It really
Absolutely.
Does. And then it's
Absolutely.
Not worlds away. It's literally... It hates to sound cheesy and corny, but it's literally a phone call away. It's literally a click on the mouse away, you know, and you could do, if you can't be there and you can't get in the trenches and get your hands dirty, find those organizations that work for you. You know, we don't have to support one or the other publicly.
Exactly.
You know, find the ones that work for you.
You know, that's a great point, and that's something that we've thought about a lot while making the film, because there was plenty of opportunities while making the film to focus on kind of this bigger problem of, you know, the lack of clean water and how many, you know, nations are enduring this problem and how big it's getting. And, you know, we really thought about it, and we knew that we didn't want to make that film once we thought about it. Like, it was so much more important for us to tell one story of one place and how this one group of people came together to fix this one problem. And just the idea that makes it so much more palpable and understandable. And, you know, like, we can wrap our heads around this, where it's like, if I start telling you how many people don't have clean water, it's very easy to just push it off and say, well, there's no way that I'm ever going to fix that. Like, dang, this is unattainable. And it becomes overwhelming very quickly. But if you tell one story and you think about one area that could use help, like, that's where true change comes from. And so we decided to stay very on the bottom level with this story and just really focus on this one story.
Yeah, because in essence, you created your own cause. I mean, you know, it was the vision of these two brothers and their father, but
right.
the cause in the end ended up being their vision, not necessarily, you know, a big name nonprofit that tries to go in and do this in communities all over the world. You know, it was just very organic.
Yeah, exactly. It was their project from the beginning to the end. Chris Madon actually engineered the entire thing, and you know, the nonprofit were there to help facilitate things, but the people of the village did the work, and Chris Madon led the work. So, you know, and Joe Sui, and so it's very much their project.
Yeah. Well, that's great, man, and how apropos that it's called the La Source.
Right? I know. we were very happy when we kind of realized that that's what we were going to name the film.
Yeah. I mean, does it mean anything other than what we think it does? Because I'm just thinking the source, but I mean...
Yeah, no, that's literally what it means. So it just kind of was very serendipitous.
Yeah. Oh, that's great, man. That's really great. Well, hey, Brandon, we look so forward to having you this weekend on the island, which I'm glad you look forward to that too. And we look forward to screening the films and let everybody see their island in a new perspective with the Catalina Explore Project first, 24-minute short documentary, and followed by La Source, which is an amazing inspirational story of these two brothers and their fight to bring some clean water to their town. It's a town, right? La Source?
Yeah, it's a small, it's a village.
Small little village in Haiti. And,
yeah.
You know, come out 1 o'clock at the Avalon Community Church and see the films, meet Brandon, give him a handshake, ask him some questions, and we'll see you there.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right, man. Thank you so much.
Sweet. I will talk to you soon, Ron.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on KISO 88.7 Avalon.